time, love, joy, I need space, love, I need me. Say hello to the girl that I am. You're gonna have to see up through my perspective. I need to make mistakes just to learn who I am. And I don't wanna be so damn protected. What am I to do to win my life?
You will find it out, don't worry.
How am I supposed to know what's right?
You just gotta do it your way.
I can't help the way I feel, but my life has been so over.
On July 13th, the Instagram page Di Prada, known for their celebrity fashion critiques, posted a series of slides to their 2.3 million followers, detailing a theory that has long circulated around certain parts of the internet, that Britney Spears is being held against her will. Under the Free Britney hashtag, Di Prada analyzes the Princess of Pop's career, detailing her childhood rise to fame, voice retraining, and infamous 2007 hospitalization and subsequent conservatorship. From songs like Overprotected, Piece of Me, or Gimme More, to stage and video performances in chains or cages, is it possible Spears has been trying to tell us something? That she's too controlled? The post reignited long-held fan theories around Spears' very private conservatorship. More recently, concerned fans have been on the lookout for coded social media posts that might indicate Spears needs our help.
All right, so in this video where she's dancing in her living room, oddly, there's a comment here that somebody says, please tell us where you are so we can save you. Fast forward to the next video, she's dancing around, and the song that she chose to dance to is none other than Malibu. Right? Those are the lyrics of the song Malibu. She's telling everybody where she's at.
Like many people, I was largely unaware of the Free Britney movement, nor was I familiar with conservatorships. What is the Free Britney movement? Free Britney is essentially, well, about freeing Britney from her current legal arrangement. For years, fans have been lobbying for Spears to be released from her conservatorship, claiming that Spears is a victim of conservatorship abuse.
There's so much conservatorship abuse that goes on, not only in Britney's case, but in so many other cases.
Spears has been under this legal arrangement since 2008. After her highly publicized 2007 and 2008 breakdowns, Spears was placed under a temporary conservatorship. By the end of the same year, it became permanent. And what exactly is a conservatorship? Known in other US states as a legal guardianship, a conservatorship places an individual under the legal responsibility of someone else. A court-appointed conservator, in this case Spears' father, Jamie Spears, assumes control over their financial and personal life. Conservatorships are generally appointed to individuals with disabilities who cannot provide for their basic needs or are considered too vulnerable to make decisions for themselves. In a leaked court document, Spears' father alleges she experiences dementia-like symptoms, but her exact diagnosis remains unknown to the public. Under her conservatorship, Spears is not allowed to make any decisions without first obtaining her father's permission. Her father reportedly has legal control over how she spends her money, when she can leave her house, what medication she takes, who she can date or spend time with, and so on. She's not allowed to drive, and she's not allowed to speak publicly about the conservatorship. Well, with the exception of the 2008 MTV documentary, Britney, for the Record.
If I wasn't under the restraints that I'm under right now, I feel so liberated. And when I tell them the way I feel, it's like they hear me, but they're really not listening.
Fans are confused why Spears needs to be under a conservatorship to begin with. Since her conservatorship began, Spears has released 4 studio albums, held a multi-year Las Vegas residency, performed 3 world tours, made countless interviews and television appearances, and so on. How can Spears possibly have a mental disability that warrants a conservatorship? As someone who identifies as disabled, I find this last question problematic. A question posed by fans, as I want to make clear. But that's a discussion for another time. I'm here instead to answer another question. Can Britney Spears vote? Welcome to my academic podcast. Throughout this episode, you may hear this sound whenever a footnote or extra commentary appears in the podcast transcript. Now that I've set up this sound function, this episode will focus on mental disability, suffrage, and disabling rhetoric. But first, can Britney Spears vote? As a resident of California, Spears can vote, as long as she can express a desire to do so. In 2016, California amended voter rights for people under conservatorship. The new amendment now establishes a presumption that a person is competent to vote regardless of their conservatorship status. While Spears would have presumably been excluded from the vote prior to the 2016 amendment, Spears will likely be able to cast a ballot in the upcoming election. However, in many other states, conservatorship status continues to disenfranchise disabled people under so-called incompetence laws. More on this later. As a disabled woman, Britney Spears is a high-profile starting point for thinking about the often overlooked connection between suffrage and disability. And, as it's the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment, which granted American white women the right to vote, I'd like to revisit the American women's suffrage movement and reconsider how disability, specifically mental disability, impacted women's suffrage. I focus here on the use of mental competency as a criteria for suffrage, a standard that continues to impact contemporary voting rights. Before we go any further, it may be helpful to provide a few examples of other marginalized communities in recent U.S. history disenfranchised on the basis of disability. Up until 1946, people with leprosy living in the Carville, Louisiana leprosy settlement were unable to vote or even marry one another. Civil War veterans living in government-funded institutions were barred from the ballot due to their residence in charitable institutions. Unsightly beggar ordinances in the late 1800s criminalized people on the basis of class, poverty, and disability. The use of literacy tests, implemented after the 15th Amendment, kept black voters from the electorate, along with poorer or uneducated white voters and immigrants. The Immigration Act of 1882 excluded immigrants with physical or mental disabilities, or anyone likely to become a public charge, and so on. What does it mean to be incompetent? The term incompetent, according to the Oxford English Dictionary, means not competent. As a noun, it means an incompetent person. The definition is circular, unstable. Who and what counts as incompetent then? Disability scholar Margaret Price explains that, quote, often the very terms used to name persons with mental disabilities have explicitly foreclosed our status as persons. Aristotle's famous declaration that man is a rational animal gave rise to centuries of insistence that to be named mad was to lose one's personhood. Or, as Catherine Prendergast puts it, to be disabled mentally is to be disabled rhetorically. People with mental disabilities, in other words, are placed in a, quote, rhetorical black hole.
When I tell them the way I feel, it's like they hear me, but they're really not listening.
Mental disability is a broad category that can include intellectual disability, developmental disability, psychiatric disability, and cognitive disability. Recently, disability activists have been reclaiming terms like crazy or mad as a way to take back rhetorical power. The terms we use matter, as they can shape and justify how people with mental disabilities are treated. A lot is at stake. field of disability studies has long been redefining and destabilizing what constitutes normal bodies or minds, putting disabled voices and bodies front and center to challenge negative understandings of disability. Throughout this episode, then, I take a disability approach to suffrage. So, what can a disability perspective do for my reading of suffrage? For one, it can expose the social attitudes and stereotypes attached to definitions of mental disability and incompetence. Second, it can expose how ideas about mental disability are used to strip different groups of their basic civil rights. Jay Dolmage, author of the book Disability Rhetoric, argues that disability is often used rhetorically as a flexible form of stigma to be freely applied to any unknown, threatening, or devalued group. And that was indeed the case, as the United States shifted from property holding and tax paying to broader qualifications for suffrage in the early 19th century. Starting in 1819, mental disability and competence standards began to be put in place to determine voting status, impacting not only people designated as having mental disabilities, but also women, Black Americans, Native Americans, other racialized communities, and immigrants. But defining competency was not straightforward. Kay Schreiner, in their survey of the use of competency in 19th century American suffrage law, explains that mental competency was, and still is, difficult to define. As one Massachusetts delegate put it in 1853, the distinction or difference between an idiot and person with just enough of an intellect to render him a responsible being and capable of exercising the civil rights of a citizen is very slight. It is very difficult to tell exactly where daylight ends and where night and darkness begins. I sat down with Dr. Yvonne Pitts, an associate professor of history at Purdue University, to learn more about mental competency, legal capacity, and citizenship in the 19th century United States. I wanted to know if there was a working definition for mental incompetence, or if everyone just knew what it was.
Right, yeah, so I mean, it's the thing, right? Well, I can't define it, but I know it when I see it, right? Didn't one of the justices say that about sexually explicit material, I think? One of the fascinating things about that category, and I'm really careful about how I talk about it, because I'm using the term capacity, and when I use that term, I'm usually speaking to a legal or civic or medical context. And I try to be really explicit about that, because at least in the 19th century in Kentucky, the definitions of this, let's just say this category, okay, and the way that this category is shaped is a really unstable part about it. But what is incredibly stable is that, especially in a post-Enlightenment or Enlightenment value constitutional order, capacity as antecedent for almost all kinds of participation, capacity is antecedent. And if someone or some group is put outside of that category, then that allows very, very, as we see, this is kind of the rigidity of the category of capacity. It allows for all kinds of prohibitions, all kinds of exclusions. I mean, you take this a step further, allows for, you know, all kinds of dehumanization, stigmas, you know, stigma, all of this kind of stuff. But that's why it's such a compelling object of study, yet it's so difficult to articulate.
Capacity, Yvonne continues.
It was absolutely central in the women's suffrage movement, but in every suffrage movement, the group claiming suffrage has to distance themselves or refute claims of unfitness or incapacity on some level. Almost all of these places involve claims of rationality or intelligence, but also other ways other forms of incapacity. So it's absolutely central to the claims that women are making to participate in the political community,
Capacity allows for all kinds of exclusions, something women experienced and wielded in their quest for suffrage, as we shall soon find out. In November of 1917, the white suffragist Alice Paul spent a week in a psychiatric ward. In a letter smuggled up from the ward, she writes,
"My sanity was doubted."
A note was allegedly written on the back of this letter. This one not from Paul.
"Why not let this miserable creature starve? The country would be much better off without her and her gang of pickets. They are a rotten lot and are crazy and should be locked up for life."
Why was Paul here? And why was her sanity under question? To answer this, let's go back 1 month prior, to when Paul was standing outside the White House, picketing for suffrage. By this point in time, authorities had begun cracking down on suffrage picket lines, charging protesters with obstruction of traffic in order to break up their frequent public demonstrations. The police picked up Paul and sentenced her to 7 months in the district jail. Once there, she began a hunger strike to protest the wrongful criminalization of suffragists, which led to a doctor writing her a prescription for the psychiatric ward.
"Dr. Gannon said that if I persisted in hunger striking, he would write a prescription to have me taken to the psychopathic ward and fed forcibly. I persisted, and was thereupon placed upon a stretcher and taken there."
It was apparently an attempt at intimidation, Paul reflects, but she later admits that she could have very well been held there forever. Questioning Paul's sanity was not an isolated incident in the push for women's suffrage. Disability, particularly mental disability, and the female body were becoming increasingly linked in late 19th century medical and political discourse, and it had dangerous consequences, allowing Paul to go from the picket line to prison to the psychiatric ward. Disability was a powerful rhetorical device, and both sides of the suffrage debate drew from it. For instance, opponents to women's suffrage associated women with disability in order to justify their ongoing disenfranchisement. Opponents argued that women were biologically disabled, pregnancy was a disability, women suffered from mental disorders or mental instability, and the demands of political life would only exacerbate their conditions. Women voting would both weaken the electoral process and damage women's reproductive capacity. Women were not considered rational and therefore would not make responsible or competent voters. Women were believed incapable of independent or original thought. Suffragists suffered from hysteria and were unhinged. Unmarried women were intellectually disabled by their unsatisfied sexuality, and so on. One may say that women became rhetorically disabled. But suffragists use many of the same rhetorical moves as their opponents, using disability to keep people out of the vote. In other words, suffragists could prove their rhetorical ability by disabling others. While suffragists argued against exclusion on the basis of gender, they appeared to have little problem excluding people on the basis of disability. In fact, suffragists consistently used disability rhetoric to argue for the right to vote. Women were politically crippled or handicapped without the right to vote. Their capacity was dwarfed by their restricted political life. According to Pauline Wright Davis, a co-founder of the National Woman Suffrage Association, women belonged to a disabled caste. Put another way, women suffered from legal disability, not mental or physical disability. One useful example I would like to draw upon is the painting American Woman and Her Political Peers. Henrietta Briggs Wall, a white suffragist, commissioned the painting for the World's Columbian Exposition in Chicago in 1893. She sold cabinet cards of the painting at the fair, and later circulated the cabinet card copies widely in the years that followed. In the center of the painting is a portrait of Frances E. Willard, a prominent white women's suffragist and the then president of the Women's Christian Temperance Union. Willard appears soberly dressed, a pair of pince-nez sitting nobly on the edge of her nose. She is surrounded by her other politically disenfranchised peers, classed at the time as follows: the idiot, the convict, the Indian, and the insane. One paper described the two men with mental disabilities as a lunatic with the glare of madness in his eyes and his garments torn by his own violence, and an idiot, one of God's creatures who, by the extinguishment of the divine light of intellect, has become a sad caricature of him in whose image man was made. I will not attempt my own visual account of the stereotypical caricatures of women's political peers. Visual description is anything but neutral, but I encourage you, dear listener, to look at the image for yourself. I will instead defer to the written accounts of Briggs Wall and a selection of her suffrage companions. Briggs Wall said of the painting,
"It strikes the woman every time. They do not realize that we are classed with idiots, criminals, and the insane as they do when they see that picture. Shocking? Well, it takes a shock to arouse some people to a sense of injustice and degradation."
In a letter to Clara Bivick Kobe, founder of the women's suffrage newspaper, The Women's Tribune, Briggs Wall explains that,
"Were it not for the sweet, serene face of Miss Willard, it would be utterly unendurable. I used almost to faint upon reaching the studio when the face of the idiot was in progress upon the canvas. But I begged the artist to soften no line of the dreadful faces of our peers. They were not intended for admiration."
The painting seemed to become quite influential in suffragist circles. The Women's Tribune sold cabinet cards of the painting for 35 cents out of their office, urging readers to own a copy of the painting themselves.
"Every suffragist should purchase a copy just to use as the last convincing argument in trying to establish the cooperation of all intelligent persons in freeing American women from the disgrace of their present political companionship."
In short, it was humiliating for women to be placed in this political category. Women did not belong in this group. One need only to look at Willard to understand this. Briggs Wall was not the only suffragist to make this argument. In an address on women's suffrage in New Jersey in 1867, Lucy Stone proposed that
"the essence of suffrage is rational choice. It follows that every individual capable of independent rational choice is rightfully entitled to vote. Idiots and lunatics are accepted because they are incapable of rational choice and so cannot vote."
This was a point that both sides of the suffrage debate appeared to agree on. Mental disability justified exclusion. Suffrage was contingent upon rational choice. Idiots and lunatics accepted because they are incapable of rational choice and so cannot vote. It appears, at least in my research, that the reasons behind excluding the idiot or the insane did not generally need explaining. There seemed to be a common understanding that people with mental disabilities would not make competent voters. While suffragists argued that they were mentally competent to vote, they did so at the expense of people with disabilities. And although white women ultimately won the right to vote, contemporary competency standards continued to disenfranchise people with mental disabilities. People continued to be removed from voting on the basis of mental incompetence, and the definitions of competency are no clearer. Why exactly does mental capacity remain linked to voting capacity? Back to Yvonne Pitts.
So, of course, ableism informs all of this, right? A couple of things. So one of the concerns is undue influence. Right, that if there's an understanding of a person, you know, so the understanding would be diminished intellectual capacity, right? So I'll say different, you know, intellectual capacity, okay? So the idea is, you know, twofold. Number one, because that person lacks, you know, reasoning and logic skills, and here I'm pointing to enlightenment rationality, because of that, that person is more susceptible to someone saying, you know, you have to vote this way, okay? So in that case, it's not a valid exercise of an independent political will. It's not a valid exercise of that, you know, political sovereignty.
One may describe this as a fear of voter fraud. If people with severe mental disabilities vote, they would allegedly be voting twice, an eerie echo of anti-suffrage sentiments that believe women would, quote, vote with their husbands, thus merely duplicating the vote.
The other piece of that, I think, is, you know, the undue influence, but also just... you know, the idea of civic participation, like this comes back to when you go from like a divinely ordained or a hereditary system of government to one in which people are, you know, select electors or are self-governing, okay? The way in which power is transferred requires a process that we all agree on. And whatever values we put into that process are the values by which we're going to determine who's in and who's out. So in that sense, you know, this idea of capacity, okay, is almost essential to democracy. It's antecedent. And so capacity, you know, in and of itself is like what values are going to be put into that container of capacity, okay? You know, because the values that are in there now are ones that are largely or often based on stigma, ableism, trans, homo, you know, anti-trans, anti, you know, I hesitate to use words homophobia because it's pathologizing rather than recognizing it as a, you know, bigoted choice.
The values that are in there now are ones that are largely or often based on stigma. Ableism informs all of this. To return to Margaret Price, to be considered incompetent is to lack rhetorosity, and quote, to lack rhetorosity is to lack all basic freedoms and rights, including the freedoms to express ourselves and the right to be listened to. Some people with disabilities communicate through assisted technology, support persons, or through nonverbal gestures, neurodivergent minds, and medicated brain fog. Their ability to persuade is complicated by a society that pays little attention to disabled bodies or minds. But disabled citizenship matters. Like, really matters. Not to mention, disabled people make up a large portion of the voter population. I'll end here with the voice of Nicole Adler, an advocate for the developmental disability and LGBTQ+ communities, addressing the importance of the disability vote in the U.S. 2020 election on her YouTube channel.
I have heard that if all people with disabilities over the age of 18 register to vote, we can be one of the most powerful voting blocks in the nation. This is something we should try to achieve, so our voices are heard and we have equal access to adequate services that met the needs of our community.
Say hello to the girl that I am. You're gonna have to see up through my perspective. I need to make mistakes just to learn who I am. And I don't wanna be so damn protected.
What am I to do to win my life?
You will find it out, don't worry.
How am I supposed to know what's right?
You just gotta do it your way.
I can't help the way I feel, but my life has been so over protected.
I say no.
Nobody's telling me just what I wanna
do.
I'm so fed up with people telling me to be.